I have measured my life with coffee spoons, says the narrator in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. It's a sentiment that many of us can identify with as we think longingly about our next cup of coffee and our next caffeine rush. But just how much is really known about caffeine, where it comes from, and how it affects us? On today's Please Explain, we'll try to fill in the gaps with Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author with Bonnie K. Beeler of The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. It's published by Psychology Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Weinberg to our show today. Welcome.
Hello, Mr. Lopate. By the way, the book is published by Routledge.
Okay. Routledge, I'm sorry, I got that wrong.
Okay.
What is caffeine? What kind of drug? How do we classify it? Is it similar to other stimulants like cocaine or amphetamines?
Caffeine stands in a unique position. It's really not very similar at all to stimulants like the methamphetamines or cocaine. It involves a completely different set of mechanisms of action and of patterns of effect and of just the way it's metabolized and the way it produces a tolerance. And it's just a completely different drug. And in fact, this is one of the keys to trying to understand why caffeine can be used by over 95% of the people in the world on a regular basis, safely and happily. And yet these other drugs, although they can produce wonderful or amazing effects, stimulating you, giving you energy and so on, if you continue to use them, they'll probably kill you. Whereas caffeine, you can use your whole life, and in fact, you'll enjoy many benefits as a result.
Although there have been suspicions against it over the years. I kept on reading scientific studies that told me caffeine was bad for me, and then scientific studies that said caffeine was all right for me, and then caffeine is good for me. For a while, I wasn't sure what to believe, and now I'm believing that caffeine is fine, and anyway, I drink a lot of coffee.
Well, I think you're all right in doing that, and I would say this. It's been an extremely baffling and confusing arena of discord and of confusion, and I must say that there's been a lot of medical or pseudo-medical misinformation about caffeine. Just to pick one example, I think, that highlights this, people are constantly saying and repeating that caffeine is bad for your cardiovascular system, for your heart, that it raises your blood pressure. They've been saying that for decades. Decades and decades. And well, this simply is not true. And many longitudinal studies, that is, conducted over 10, 20 years of tens of thousands of people, the Tromso Heart Study, Framingham Heart Study, Honolulu Heart Study, proved decades ago that caffeine did not increase cardiovascular pathology. It simply didn't do that. Now, there was suspicion that caffeine might actually have a beneficial effect on the heart, but they couldn't prove it. Within a couple of years ago, there was another massive longitudinal study that showed that caffeine use decreased all-cause mortality in people. In other words, the more caffeine you use, the less likely you were to die. In other words, it extended your life.
So you can't overdose on caffeine.
Well, just a second. Let me say this. The key, the most important factor in caffeine's extending your life is its benefits to the heart. So, I mean, this is just a lot of nonsense. Now, as far as you can't overdose on caffeine, well, that's not really true. I suppose that you can overdose on any drug. And if you took poisonous amounts of colossal amounts of caffeine, you would have problems. In fact, you could kill yourself that way. But the normal dietary levels of caffeine don't pose those kinds of dangers. The primary problem with caffeine use is if you are super sensitive to it, then you might be a person who, if he has a cup of coffee in the morning, can't even sleep at night. If you're like that, then you better give up your caffeine or you have a problem. But most people are not in that category. But really the key to all this is understanding what caffeine does to you and for you. There's no rule for everybody.
How long have humans been using caffeine? Was coffee the first vehicle that they got their caffeine from?
No, that's a very good question. There's quite a mystery about the origins of coffee, and probably coffee was the earliest, but we don't really know. Coffee grows wild all over Africa, and it was understood that the natives did grind the beans and mix them with fat and eat them and get stimulation from that, but we don't really know much about this prehistory. We have no written records, obviously. And strangely enough, and it is strange, around the beginning of the 16th century, coffee drinking began in and around Mecca. And by the time there were historians that were writing accounts trying to figure out where this coffee came from and so on within a few years, and they started coffee houses and so on, these historians, who were excellent scholars, found that even though there were still people alive who could remember a time when coffee didn't exist, when they didn't know about it, they still couldn't figure out where it came from, even then. Whether it came from North Africa, whether it came from the mountains of Mecca, we really don't know. But somehow, in some strange way, coffee appeared. The first coffee house was opened around 1511 in Mecca. And it just went on from there in tremendous rates, spread through the Arab world and then across the entire world. Where it was before 1500 is quite strange and mysterious, because once it was discovered, it took over the world.
Its name, caffeine, I assume, the German word, comes from the German word for coffee, café.
That's right.
Now, don't non-coffee plants also produce caffeine? I know tea, of course, has a lot of caffeine, and I wonder whether the Chinese weren't drinking tea before people were drinking coffee in Mecca. But doesn't it also occur as a natural pesticide?
Well, first of all, it is a natural pesticide, and that is the reason that plants produce it, to kill bugs and to protect them from infection and so on.
Can I spray coffee on my plants and protect my plants?
Yes, actually, and caffeine is used sometimes mixed with the soil around plants to kill offending materials, and it does work. It is used as an insecticide. It has been used that way. It's safe, but that's why it came into existence in this world. So it's truly strange that we human beings should find, by some strange turn of events, that this drug that was created to kill bugs actually has a tremendous number of beneficial effects on our bodies, on our minds, on our emotions, on combating disease entities, on doing so many things. It's actually quite remarkable, and even, I would say, a little difficult to believe sometimes. And when I wrote some of these books, I didn't begin as a caffeine booster. I, in fact, did not want to write these books. I thought, well, gee, I love coffee, and I don't want to find out that, you know, all the terrible things it does to you, and I don't even want to know. But my partner convinced me that it was a good idea to write a book about this, Bonnie Beeler. She said, look, people have to know about this stuff, and there's no good book on caffeine. There isn't, and it's so we should write one. Well, we began researching it. We discovered there was an entire world of cultural history surrounding the use of this drug, which is not really that surprising because it's used by almost everyone everywhere. But also we found out that there was a tremendous list of beneficial effects and very few harmful effects to even consider. There are a couple.
I'm talking with Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author with Bonnie K. Beeler of The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug. It's published by Routledge. This is Please Explain on WNYC, 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How much caffeine is there in a single cup of coffee? Would it vary from cup to cup? And should I assume that the stronger the cup of coffee, the more caffeine it will have?
Well, that's a very confusing question, and really is one of the baffling parts of using caffeine and using it properly and to the best effect. Yes, the amount of caffeine in a cup of coffee varies enormously, and really the fact that it's stronger doesn't necessarily mean that it has more caffeine, but probably it does. You know, a cup of instant coffee in the 1950s had about 100 milligrams of caffeine, and oddly enough, still when scientists do studies, they talk as if a cup of coffee has 100 milligrams grams of caffeine, but that's no longer true. An average Starbucks cup of coffee has at least 200 milligrams of caffeine. So, and it goes on up from there, and it varies, and it's really, really difficult to tell. Unless you use caffeine pills, it's very difficult to regulate your dose very exactly. You can do it to a certain extent, but you have to be careful.
Well, how do you decaffeinate coffee? I know there are a number of different processes, some involving chemicals that don't sound all that healthy, and then others using water.
Well, there are many methods of decaffeinating coffee, and there are some that are very benign, and most are pretty benign. But one of the problems with that is the extent to which the decaffeination has been carried out is sometimes that varies, too. In other words, sometimes there is some caffeine in so-called decaffeinated coffee, and it's hard to really know for sure. And even a little caffeine, as I said, people's sensitivity varies a lot. And this is one of the tricks of caffeine use. If you want to use it well and properly and to your benefit, you have to pay attention to what it does to you. If a little bit has a strong effect on you, then you better not use more than a little bit.
Does it add to the flavor?
Yes.
Because decaffeinated coffees, until fairly recently, always seemed to be a bit weaker, a bit more tepid. Now they seem to be making some where there's practically no discernible difference in taste, but I was wondering whether taking out the caffeine actually did have an effect on the taste.
Yes, it does. Caffeine adds a kind of pointed, what people call a point to the taste. It's kind of a sharpness, an edge to it that's considered very pleasurable and good. And when you remove the caffeine, you remove that as well. And so really the caffeine does add something to the flavor of coffee.
Now, what about tea? Because I've been told tea has more caffeine than coffee, but it doesn't keep you awake at night.
Well, you see, this is, again, a kind of a confusion. Tea does have more caffeine than coffee, yet it doesn't have more caffeine than coffee. How can I say that? Well, a pound of tea has more caffeine in it than a pound of coffee. But you see, when you're making tea, you use very, very tiny amounts where you use more coffee. So the truth is that a cup of tea has much less caffeine than a cup of coffee. So that's really what we're interested in. We're not interested in what a pound has because we're not consuming it in raw bulk form. We're consuming it in beverages. So as a beverage, tea, although there's a range of caffeine contents in different teas, it always is less than there is in coffee, considerably less, dramatically less. And if you have a little trouble with caffeine consumption, sometimes a good thing to do is to try tea and maybe stick with it.
What about other drinks, cola drinks, chocolate? They have caffeine, don't they? And then there are manufactured drinks like Red Bull. Are some of them more effective at delivering caffeine than others?
Well, again, a complicated question. First of all, these Red Bull-type drinks, it's kind of a bit of a joke because they do contain more caffeine, say, than Coca-Cola, but they contain much less caffeine than coffee. So the idea that somehow you're getting a supercharge of caffeine when you drink Red Bull is a delusion. I mean, you are getting some caffeine, and you are getting effective doses of caffeine, but you're getting less than you would get if you drank coffee. So really, that is kind of a misconception. Now, what was the other part of your question? I'm sorry, sir.
I was wondering about about chocolate and cola.
Yes.
It occur naturally in the cocoa bean and in the cola bean?
Yes. In fact, you had asked me before about the question of whether caffeine occurs outside of coffee. Indeed, it does. It not only occurs in tea, it occurs in a South American plant called mate, another South American plant called guarana. It also occurs in the cola nut, which grows in Africa. And it does, in fact, occur in chocolate and cocoa beans. However, the active theobromine constituent in cocoa beans, it's really theobromine as opposed to caffeine. In other words, it's a very closely related drug to caffeine, very close, but a little different. But again, the amounts of caffeine in chocolate are relatively small compared with coffee.
Although people consider chocolate addictive, and we know that coffee can be called addictive because coffee drinkers have a letdown if they don't have their regular dose of caffeine. What makes it addictive?
Well, let me comment on that. Now, when we wrote the book, The World of Caffeine, we occasionally used the word addiction to describe caffeine's effects. And many scientists, doctors who were involved in caffeine studies, and so on, contacted us and said, this isn't right. You shouldn't call caffeine addictive. That is a misuse of the word addiction. Addictive drugs are not only drugs that produce a metabolic tolerance, but they're also drugs that cause destruction in a person's life. Now, no one's ever lost his house, his car, or his wife because he was a caffeine user. And really, the patterns of abuse that occur with alcohol and heroin and cocaine and so on, which properly are described as addictive, really don't attach to caffeine use. And we were told you shouldn't call it addictive. It's really not. It does form a metabolic tolerance. But a lot of drugs, in fact, one might say even most drugs, can, for example, Prozac. If you take Prozac, it produces a tolerance and a dependence. And when you stop taking it, you should taper off. But that doesn't mean Prozac is addictive. It's not addictive, and neither is caffeine, not really. But it does produce a metabolic tolerance, and if you want to stop using it, you'd be well advised to taper off your use. It's as simple as that. But you're probably not going to get divorced because you had a caffeine problem.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking calls from our listeners. Also, listeners are leaving comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Our phone number is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And my guest is Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author with Bonnie K. Beeler of The World of Caffeine, the Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug, published by Routledge. This is Please Explain. We're looking at caffeine. We might be on a radio show, but we're certainly not camera shy. And you can go to our Flickr page or check out our Facebook wall to see the latest pictures from our studio. Just head to WNYC.org for more details. And don't forget to tune in on Monday when I'll be taking the day off, but we'll have a special guest host, Christopher Walken. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
Was jetzt nun geschieht? Da kommt Herr Schlendrian mit seiner Tochter Lieschen hier. Er kommt ja wie ein Zeilenbild. Er selber, was sie ihm.
This is Johann Sebastian Bach's Coffee Cantata, also titled Be Still, Stop Chattering. Bach wrote it as a comic opera about coffee addiction, which was a pressing social problem in the city of Leipzig, where this premiered. One of the lyrics complains, "If I can't drink my bowl of coffee three times daily, then in my torment I will shrivel up like a piece of roast goat." Well, I hope none of you are shriveling up while you're waiting for us to take your calls at 212-433-9692. How did he come up with shriveling like a piece of roast goat? Did people actually feel that if you didn't drink coffee, you shriveled up?
Well, I don't think so. I think that's kind of a hyperbolic expression, but he just means that you're going to feel bad and you're going to miss the benefits and enjoyments that caffeine provides. I mean, you know, some people say, and it's really not accurate, that the benefits that caffeine provides, it just relieves your metabolic deficiency when you don't have it. But that's not true. The truth is, whether you have any metabolic need or not, caffeine provides a slew of beneficial effects on how you feel. And really, one of caffeine's most wonderful effects, aside from the fact that it basically raises your IQ on a short-term basis, it helps you perform muscular activities and sports, does just burns fat, does all these different things. But really, perhaps the single most wonderful thing it does is improves your mood. And, you know, life can be pretty tough, and to have something safe that makes you feel a little happier. You know, Roland Griffiths, who's the leading caffeine researcher in America at Johns Hopkins University, and who's not a really big caffeine booster, has proven that 100 milligrams of caffeine a day will improve your mood for the whole day. So that's why people smile when they walk by Starbucks.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, so I'm just saying, so this is really a truly wonderful thing. And I mean, a lot of drugs will improve your mood, but most of them will end up by destroying your life. Caffeine doesn't do that. So
we have Juliet from New Jersey who has some concerns. Hi, Juliet.
Hi, Leonard. Quick question. You know, there's so many conflicting reports about caffeine and pregnancy. I'm pregnant and I'm drinking coffee, and you know, I keep hearing good and bad things. I'm kind of just going with it. But do you have a thought about that?
Yes, I do, and I think it's a very serious issue. And the one health effect that I think should be taken seriously, and the one warning I think should be taken seriously, is that caffeine should be avoided by pregnant women. And there's very little question of that. And some of the researchers that have done studies on its effect on pregnancy have been a little bit confused in terms of their recommendations.
What does it do?
Well, it has many effects or potential effects on fetal development, on pregnancy. And one, for example, it can increase the number of miscarriages. Now, 100 milligrams a day of caffeine isn't going to increase miscarriages. 300 milligrams might. Well, a cup and a half of Starbucks coffee, that would be 300 milligrams. So that's confusing because some of these researchers will tell you that's three cups of coffee, but it isn't. But you see, miscarriages, that's only one thing. Caffeine, you know, pregnant women don't metabolize caffeine the way people who aren't pregnant metabolize caffeine. Its metabolism is dead slow in their systems, and the fetus is bathed in caffeine. And caffeine is the kind of drug, for various reasons that I can't go into right now, but that really might affect fetal development. Now, does it? Well, the truth is that if you bathe the fetus in caffeine, you might be producing neurological deficits and problems that arise later in life, cause attention deficits, learning problems, mood disorders. Well, does it? Well, we don't know because it's never been studied.
Well, should Juliet just cut down on her coffee intake, maybe one cup a day?
In my opinion, she should cut it out because...
You hear that, Juliet?
Yeah, I hear it.
She's not risking a miscarriage if she only drinks a little, but she is risking potential damage to the fetus later in life. Now, this has never been proven, but it's never been studied in the long term. So it's highly questionable whether you want to subject your fetus to a bath of a drug that very well might and that reasonably could really affect its development, in CNS development, really.
Okay, well, should we move on to another call? Catherine from Massapequa, Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've recently heard that people that are insulin intolerant, pre-diabetic, or even diabetic should avoid caffeine because it messes with their the way they metabolize sugar.
Well, that's actually another very confusing area. The truth is that caffeine has been cited as something that helped the use of caffeine can help prevent the onset of diabetes, and it can actually help control diabetes. And yet there have been some people that have said it can have the other effect. So it's hard to be absolutely sure about that. But as far as I know, most of the evidence is that caffeine is benign in that regard and may even be beneficial.
And then others want to know about whether it causes hydration, whether it also depletes calcium in the body?
Good questions. Yes, caffeine is constantly cited as something that dehydrates you. That's simply not true. Caffeine does not alter the fluid balance of the organs of the body. This has been absolutely proven. Now, people do urinate more frequently after drinking a lot of coffee. They also urinate after drinking a lot of water, and they also sometimes start urinating just from moving around. So your urination can increase, but your fluid balance in your body, in your organs, is not depleted at all by caffeine. And you know, when you lose a little water, if you need a little water, you take a drink of water. So really, it is not an issue. It doesn't make any sense, and it's simply not true that caffeine dehydrates you. It's simply not true. Now, as far as calcium, there's been a lot of studies on that. Some went two ways, but I'm convinced that the most recent and the most probative studies show that it does not deplete calcium. And even the implications were that it was such a small depletion that, you know, 1 ounce of milk would make up for the depletion,
What about the effect of caffeine on our pets, dogs and cats? Isn't it dangerous for them?
Yes, it is, especially for dogs. It's quite poisonous for dogs.
Is it the same reason we don't want our dogs to eat chocolate?
Yes, exactly. It's quite bad for them. And I don't even remember exactly why but it is. It's definitely a no-no for dogs.
Well, don't let your pregnant dog drink coffee for sure. Dan from Bridgewater, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You know, there's a new field called pharmacogenomics where you're looking at the genetic qualities of people that distinguish one from the other, how drugs affect them. And caffeine is a particularly difficult drug to deal with because it's an intermediary in a long series of processes that act in the nervous system and activate or deactivate certain neurotransmitters that inhibit activity or promote activity. So this complexity makes it impossible to study it in people because, you know, like lobotomy, it took them 30 years to find out how deleterious an operation it is. And the same way with coffee. You can't just give various doses to people and see what their tolerance limits and so on are. So these various studies don't really say anything because the individual reactivities of people are so variable due to their genetic makeup that we really can't speak about this. So each one, as you said earlier, should decide for himself on the basis of the reaction and should also know that over time, caffeine has very different effects than it may have had the first time, the second time, or so on. And people should get used to the idea that their bodies and their lives are much more complex than they would think casually, and they have to study these things much more completely.
Thank you for calling us, Dan. Dan, you're a neurophysiologist?
Yes, a physician, too.
I'm sure you agree with most of that or all of that, Dr. Weinberg.
Yes, I would say that what this gentleman has to say is very probative, and it is true. It really, there is a lot of variety in reactions to caffeine, and it is based on genetic predispositions. And the mechanisms of action of caffeine are very complex, and indeed it does really affect a whole series of mechanisms in the body, various neurotransmitters. It has a primary effect on the adenosine system, but the adenosine system affects other neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. So really there is a kind of domino effect, and it's very difficult, extremely difficult, to really understand exactly what caffeine is doing and why it's doing it. It's a little easier to do studies to see if, on a longitudinal basis of studies of tens of thousands of people, if in fact there's any dose-dependent relationship between caffeine use and a certain pathology. For example, you can take 10,000 people, study them for 20 years, measure their caffeine intake, and see if they have more heart problems or fewer heart problems. But still, understanding exactly why it's doing what it's doing and really knowing what it's going to do to you, that's tricky. And you really have to try to focus on yourself if you want to get the most out of caffeine and use it successfully and safely.
My guest is Bennett Allen Weinberg, co-author with Bonnie K. Beeler of The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug, published by Routledge. And we're talking about caffeine on today's Please Explain. Along these lines, Karen left a comment on our show page saying, coffee has no effect on me. If anything, coffee makes me sleepy. What could cause this opposite effect?
Well, once again, it's hard to know. Once you get into the mechanism of action question, it is difficult to understand how. But people do vary tremendously. And in fact, I've heard this before. There are a certain number of people. They're not too many in percentage, but there are a lot of them out there because there are a lot of people out there that really have a paradoxical effect to caffeine. And why that is, I can't explain, but it's true. And it's everything from making you a little sleepy to not having any effect on you, to only having a slightly stimulating effect on you, to having a very stimulating effect on you, to having an effect that's so stimulating that you just can't use it. So it really runs the gamut, you know. But most people can use fairly substantial dietary amounts of caffeine successfully and to their benefit.
Now, they often put caffeine in some other drugs, I guess, the ones that make you sleepy, like Excedrin, some of the antihistamine drugs. That's to counteract the effect of the antihistamines?
Actually, I'm not familiar with the addition of caffeine to antihistamines. As far as adding it to things like Excedrin, there's a reason for that. Caffeine is a very strong painkiller, and it's been proven that caffeine will kill pain as strongly as Advil will. And if you combine them, you get even a better pain relief. And this means if you have a toothache and you take some caffeine, there's a good chance that toothache will disappear. Huh? It won't cure your tooth, but it does kill the pain. It's a very strong painkiller. So it is added to painkillers. It used to be more frequently added to aspirin products. For some reason, when they went from aspirin to Tylenol, they dropped the caffeine in most drugs. I don't really know why they did that, but it definitely increases the painkilling power of aspirin, of ibuprofen, and it just is a good painkiller itself.
A listener wonders, how does the roasting process affect caffeine? Does a darker roast burn off caffeine? Does an espresso have more caffeine than a cup of drip coffee made from the same bean?
No, espresso does not have more caffeine. It has more caffeine per ounce, but you drink a much smaller cup. And in fact, roasting, especially dark roasting, does in fact destroy some of the caffeine content. So it is a confusing thing. And again, it's one of the reasons I said it was difficult to estimate how much caffeine you're getting when you're having a cup of coffee, because it can mean so many things. But yes, so the espresso is concentrated, but it really doesn't have as much caffeine as a full-bodied cup of coffee, a little espresso.
Harvey from Queens, how you're on the air.
Two things. One, I've read that the drip method of preparing coffee is carcinogenic. And two, green tea and black tea are both powerful antioxidants. I wonder whether anything on coffee acts as an antioxidant.
Is it the drip method or the percolator method?
I could be wrong. It could be the percolator. One of the methods is carcinogenic.
Is that true, Doctor?
Well, I'm not familiar with that. I'm familiar with certain dangers that come out of the infusion pot method of making coffee, which is common in Europe, which doesn't use a filter. You just pour the boiling water into a beaker that contains the coffee, and then you let it sit, and then you squeeze out the coffee from it. The problem is there's no filter, and the problem is that coffee contains a lot of things that can raise cholesterol. And if the filter gets rid of those things, but when there's no filter, if you drink unfiltered coffee, it will raise your cholesterol over time and will cause heart problems.
When you're talking about a filter, are you talking about paper filters or
yeah,
are the gold filters as effective?
Filter.
Not
paper
gold filters?
Filter. Not a gold filter, no. A paper filter. And this is one of the reasons that there was some suspicion that caffeine might protect the heart, because it was found that people that drank infusion coffee had increased heart problems. But people that drank decaf infusion coffee had increased heart problems. People that drank caffeinated infusion coffee didn't have increased heart problems. So people said, gee, is there some protective effect of caffeine? And the answer has been proven that there is a strong protective effect. Nevertheless, coffee unfiltered can increase your cholesterol and therefore can hurt your heart. Now, I forget the other thing this gentleman said.
Well, we have percolator and carcinogen. But we have pretty much run out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. But it has been a fascinating conversation, and my great thanks to you for talking with us today. Dr. Bennett Allen Weinberg is co-author with Bonnie K. Beeler of The World of Caffeine, The Science and Culture of the World's Most Popular Drug, which is published by Routledge. And we have been talking about caffeine on today's Please Explain segment. Sorry we couldn't get to all the calls, but, well, you can always address this again sometime in the future. On Monday's show, guest host Christopher Walken speaks first with three-time Tony Award winner Jack O'Brien, and then with actress Zoe Kazan, who starred with Walken in A Behanding in Spokane. She talks about her illustrious family and her roles on stage and screen, including the upcoming production of Angels in America. Also, Jacques d'Amboise, recognized as one of the finest classical dancers of our time, discusses his work in the field of arts education. And chef Lydia Bastianich and her mother, Erminia Motica, talk about cooking Italian food and their shared roots with Walken in Astoria, Queens. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Blakeney Schick, and Kim Gittleson. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Matt Joseloff, Matt Gurry, Drew Katchen, and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Tune in on Monday.